It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Central Time, we talk to Senator Tammy Baldwin about college affordability and student loan debt, likely topics at tonight's State of the Union address.
First, the Wisconsin State Assembly is in session today. Lawmakers are considering a package of bills known as the HOPE Agenda. HOPE stands for heroin, opiate prevention, and education.
The Assembly passed that plan earlier today. It goes to the Senate now. John Nygren's the lawmaker behind these bills and other legislation to fight heroin and opiate abuse in Wisconsin. It's a personal issue for him because his daughter Cassie has struggled with opiate addiction for the past 10 years.
We talked with John Nygren about this legislation earlier today. He's a Republican state lawmaker who represents the 89th Assembly District, which includes Marinette. Representative Nygren, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Well, we've talked to you in the past about bills targeting heroin abuse. What's the focus of your new legislation?
It's really, heroin obviously is a part of the discussion. It's not where it starts. Unfortunately, sadly, it's often where it ends, whether it be in addiction or whether it be in overdose death. It starts with prescription drugs in 80 to 90% of the cases, oftentimes legally prescribed prescription drugs. So the focus this session is more about prescription drugs and changing the dialogue with the public. I don't think anybody really thinks that they're susceptible to heroin use, but I think there's better understanding of the potential from a prescription drug addiction, and that's really why we need to have this conversation.
And it seems like an overview of your bills, this is targeted at data and communication. Would you see it that way?
It's tools, definitely, data communication, but the data really deals with the when you go to the clinic, when you go to the doctor, when you're picking up that prescription. We created a prescription drug monitoring program in Wisconsin some years ago. It went live in July of 2014, where a doctor enters, or a doctor is not required to, but a doctor can enter information into a database at the pharmacy when it's picked, a prescription is picked up, and then the doctor can review that information before they prescribe to their patients. Unfortunately, only about 14% of our doctors are utilizing that system. So if that tool exists, we really need to make it more functional. And to make it more functional, the doctors need to be utilizing it. So the pharmacies are going to be entering that information within 24 hours, and the doctors will be required to look at the database to make sure that this patient they're seeing is not drug-seeking, not looking to because of an addiction, but that the prescription is truly needed for pain management.
So you want physicians to have to check this database before they prescribe the narcotics. What kind of feedback have you gotten from doctors about that?
Of course, with anything that's new and a change, there's some opposition, but for the most part, we got to a position where either the medical field, the medical society, hospitals, other providers are either neutral or even supportive because they understand how big this problem really is, and they want to be a part of the solution. They accept the responsibility that they've been part of creating it, and now they want to be part of the solution too. So, for the most part, very positive, but of course, there's always some opposition.
Now, moving to the law enforcement side of things, you would like law enforcement to report it when they see signs of prescription drugs being stolen or abused. How do you see this fitting into the big picture?
There was a recent study by the Annals of Internal Medicine, a respected national medical group, that found that 90% of all people who overdose on an opiate actually get re-prescribed the same medication, oftentimes by the same doctor. So let me say that again, 90% of all people who overdose based on an opiate prescription get re-prescribed the same drug again, oftentimes by the same doctor. So we see this law enforcement piece as if they find it at a scene of an overdose, they find it at the scene of a crime, they're going to report it to the prescription drug monitoring program, and the doctor is made aware of this problem so that they can adjust their prescribing practices to basically do no harm, which is a physician's number one responsibility.
And another piece of this puzzle here of these bills is pain clinics and methadone clinics. You'd like them to register with the state. How would that work?
Well, methadone clinics are federally regulated, so we don't know a lot about them, but I guess the concern is here we want to make sure that these treatments are effective. We've heard anecdotally about patients at methadone clinics who are on methadone for long terms, 5 to 10 years at high doses, and basically what they are is they're functional addicts rather than recovering addicts. Our objective should be get people to a point of recovery and become productive citizens. So really what that's about is just collecting data to help us better understand understand what these methadone clinics are doing. Pain management, the bill that we have in front of us is really putting us in a position on defense. Wisconsin doesn't have a huge problem with pill mills or clinics that are actually pumping out a large amount of opiate medications. Other states do. We're really more in a defensive mode to make sure that we don't have that problem in Wisconsin in the future.
We're talking with Representative John Nygren, talking about a new suite of bills aimed at addressing opiate and heroin abuse here in Wisconsin. And you've seen bipartisan support for some of these measures, similar measures, in the past. Do you think that you'll see that same thing this time around?
I do, and I think the reason that is, I mean, it's both gratifying to me personally to have bipartisan support, but it's also somewhat underscores the problem in that legislators represent their areas. They do their best to represent the area that they come from, and this unanimous support last session really tells you that this is not just a problem in my part of the Wisconsin, northeast Wisconsin, but it's north, south, east, west, large communities, small communities. This is really hitting all over our state, and we need to do what we can from a public safety and public health standpoint to put the tools in place to reduce this problem we're seeing.
Now, this is an issue that's personal to you. Your daughter, Cassie, had issues with heroin in the past, and she's a recovered addict now. How do you feel you've done as you work with lawmakers to try to curb this epidemic in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, we're proud of what we've accomplished. I think we've all, working together, have saved lives. There's no doubt about it, but we have more of a problem to overcome. And when talking about Cassie, and I think this is an important part for anybody to understand how big of an issue this really is, this is, you know, a mistake that you could make in your youth by becoming addicted to prescription drugs, which later led to heroin in her case, and overdose with potential, almost passed away. Is not something that goes away. Once you're addicted to these drugs, this is a lifelong battle. Cassie's in recovery, but she's not recovered. She'll face this the rest of her life. So the measures we're trying to take are trying to prevent others from making the same mistakes that Cassie made.
Now, you mentioned that you want this to change the conversation that we have about heroin and opiate abuse here in Wisconsin. How do you want us to talk about the issue right now?
Well, when you go to the clinic, when you go to the dentist, you know, whatever it might be, when the doctor is talking about pain management and they pull out the pad and offer to write a prescription for OxyContin or Vicodin, I want people to actually, you know, consider, are there other means? My two younger kids both had, you know, wisdom teeth and teeth pulled for preparation of orthodonture work last year, and in both cases they wanted to prescribe Vicodin to these kids. And, you know, we asked the question as parents, are there other ways to treat this? And the doctor said, oh, sure, we could do it with over-the-counter, you know, ibuprofen or, you know, Tylenol. I want parents to be engaged in that conversation to say, you know, if we can treat it in other ways, shouldn't we? Well, you know, the United States is 4.6% of the world's population, yet we take 80% of the opiate drugs. That's shocking. We need to do better. We need to treat our pain in other ways, and we need to educate our population that there are other options other than the painkillers that have become so prevalent.
Now, assuming that these bills make it through the legislature, they become law, what's next in the fight against heroin abuse in Wisconsin?
Well, I think the continued challenges we face are, you know, treatment. We provided some more resources for treatment and diversion programs, and we have another proposal to do that in this session. But, you know, ongoing treatment is a problem. Detoxification, when somebody actually wants to break the cycle, it's very difficult to stop taking and getting into a treatment program. In most cases, you can't be actively using to get into treatment. So detox is important. Sober living after you've actually gone through treatment, people that will support you in your recovery, and then in jobs. Quite honestly, people that will actually hire, in a lot of cases, people that might have a criminal record, and give them a chance. So those are all pieces of the puzzle in long-term recovery, and those are things that we're going to continue to be working on.
Representative Nygren, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for highlighting this problem in our state.
That was Representative John Nygren, Republican state lawmaker who represents the 89th Assembly District, which includes Marinette. He joined us earlier today to talk about his legislation to help prevent heroin and opiate abuse in Wisconsin. Tonight, President Obama will deliver his final State of the Union address. The president has brought up student loan debt and higher education costs in previous addresses, and Senator Tammy Baldwin hopes that will be a big part of tonight's speech.
Tammy Baldwin joins us now. Senator Baldwin, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, it's a delight. Thank you.
Well, why did you want to focus specific attention on the issue of college affordability as we run up to the State of the Union address tonight?
Well, it is such a critical issue facing not just students and graduates and parents of students, but frankly, it's an issue that faces our nation's entire economy. Because as students are grappling with these incredible debt burdens, they're finding not only does it affect their choices after school, but it's also a drag on the economy overall as they have less capacity to buy houses, to buy new cars, to start a small business. And that impacts all of us. So I think this is the crisis of our times, and that I'm certainly hoping to hear from our president at the State of the Union tonight that this is a high priority for him and our nation.
I understand you have a UW Parkside student, Brittany Woods, as your guest at the address tonight. Can you talk about Brittany's story and why it fits into all of this?
Absolutely. I met Brittany at a student roundtable that I held earlier in 2015 at UW Parkside. And after hearing her story at the roundtable, not only her personal story of struggling to afford a higher education and not really having had the background in what she would need to know to apply for grants and financial aid, I also was really inspired by the fact that she's become an advocate for fellow students and the next generation of students to come after. And so it was my honor to give her a call and invite her to be my guest at the President's State of the Union address so that she can amplify her voice in highlighting the need for Washington to take action on college affordability and the student debt crisis.
Have you found that college debt, college affordability is an issue, unlike a lot of issues, that Republicans and Democrats could actually work together on?
Well, I think that it is precisely the type of issue that we need to work together on. And sometimes it it frustrates me and stymies me that that they haven't embraced our efforts to confront the enormous debt loads that students are facing and parents of students are facing, but also affordability moving forward so that the next generation can afford to get the higher education preparation they need to start new careers. Student debt is not, we're not able to refinance it because of impediments in the federal law. But if you buy a house, you can refinance the house when the interest rates go down. You can refinance an automobile. You can refinance a small business loan. This kind of sticks out as the sole exception, and it doesn't make sense. And I think that we can come together to change that, and I certainly hope we do.
Is that one of your top priorities, one of the things you're hoping to hear from the president, that refinancing issue?
Well, I really think we have to take a longer range view on this. The student debt piece of this is it's hit crisis proportions. We have $1.3 trillion in aggregate student debt in this nation. About 40 million people hold student debt. There are people who are becoming Social Security eligible and still have debt from their higher education. It's just a real crisis. But it is not enough. We also have to confront the costs of getting a higher education moving forward so that this doesn't just replicate itself with the next generation of incoming students. So that's where I also place a high priority on the affordability side. And I've introduced legislation called the America's College Promise Act, which would help students access the first 2 years of college tuition free. So this would be at a community college or a technical college. It's recognizing that in the 21st century skills-based economy, that people really need 14 years of preparation, not just 12, to get a good start in their careers and their life ahead of them.
Would those 2 years, would that be need-based? Somebody in financial need would get that? Or is that something you'd try to apply to all students across the board?
The America's College Promise Act applies to all students, and it is really a federal-state partnership, obviously voluntary from the state's perspective. But we're seeing states like Tennessee and Oregon try this out, and with great success, and we're talking about a red state as well as a blue state, so this is not something that needs to be partisan. But I think that if you look back to Wisconsin's history and the commitment that we made a century, well over a century ago, to write into our Constitution access to a free public education for all of our children, at that point in time, it contemplated that 12 years of education was enough to give somebody a start in a career. And we know today in our high-skills economy that more preparation is needed. And I think we ought to make maybe a K through 14 commitment for the 21st century. And that's what this legislation that I've introduced embodies, and that's the spirit behind it. And I also have to say it was inspired by the president's call for Congress to make this investment in his State of the Union last year.
It sounds expensive, this idea of providing. This is a lot of students, potentially, we're talking about.
There's no question that it would be a lot of students. They say the estimates are that about 9 million students nationally could benefit if this were fully implemented across the country. Community college and technical colleges tend to have lower tuition than some of the other institutions out there, but it is a significant commitment in our workforce and in our young people's future.
Talking to U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin about college affordability in the run-up to tonight's State of the Union address. So when we talk about higher education, there's been a strain of argument, and this has come up in the presidential race some. Maybe we're sending too many people into college, especially along paths that we don't need more of. No more philosophers, for example, I think Marco Rubio was saying. Is government assistance, in effect, giving kids an incentive to pursue expensive college tracks that might not end up being valid career tracks?
Well, you know, I really think that we ought to re-examine this. We're going to have an opportunity in this coming year when the Senate Education Committee, on which I sit, reauthorizes the Higher Education Act. And part of, I don't fall quite into Marco Rubio's camp on this, because I find that a liberal arts education is of enormous value. But we have a lot of folks who are very focused and very interested in getting the skills they need to compete in the 21st century economy. I hear from employers in Wisconsin all the time that there is a skills gap between what they are looking for in terms of hiring and what the local workforce has to offer. And I do think we need to do a better job of matching that. And part of what that involves is partnerships at the local level between area employers, area industry, and the technical colleges and community colleges in the regions of our state. They're a model, frankly, in Wisconsin, and they're doing heroic work in terms of helping us recover from the deep recession that we experienced in the late 2000s. That said, we can still do better to try to match and align student interests with jobs available in the area and sort of counteract the brain drain that we complain about a lot.
One argument about the cost of college, the high cost of college, is that the cost is really high. Tuitions are really high. We've seen some tuition freezes here in UW system schools over the years. Is there something that the federal government could do to keep those costs down, regardless of if the student is paying or the parent is paying or some kind of federal financial aid is paying?
You know, there's no question in my mind that we can do better with regard to accountability of our institutions for higher education. I mean, there's was a huge pushback when the president said, "I want more transparent data on how many of your graduates get jobs in their chosen field, how long does it take to get them, what is the cost per credit, and are you doing innovation? Are you thinking about new ways in the 21st century to deliver the higher education that people need. So I do think we can take additional steps, and whether it is a sort of scoreboard or, you know, that involves better transparency of these sort of outcomes, or whether it's other ways to hold the institutions accountable, students need to be able to review that type of information before making their college choice.
Senator Baldwin, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Senator Tammy Baldwin talking about student loan debt and the cost of higher education and her hopes for that topic being addressed in tonight's State of the Union address. And by the way, President Obama's address before a joint session of Congress will air tonight at 8 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. The coverage hosted by NPR's Audie Cornish. The live special will feature the Republican response as well. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. A national study just released last month shows that young couples, especially women, get the same emotional boost from living together as they do from marriage. But the emotional benefits change when you're talking about women or men.
We're taking your calls on cohabitation at 800-642-1234. Do you think it's a good idea for couples to live together before they get married or instead of getting married? What emotional benefits did you get from moving in with your partner, married or not? Do you know someone in this situation? Friend, family member, how do you see it working for them? And do you have questions for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Claire Camp Dush is one of the co-authors of this new study. She's an associate professor of human sciences at Ohio State University, and she joins us from the studios there. Claire, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's start by defining emotional benefits. What does that mean and what are they?
The emotional benefits that we're looking at are really mental health benefits. So would be a change in how often you felt blue in the past few weeks or how you've been feeling overall about your life.
And so what did you go into the study looking for? What did you want to find?
Well, we were interested in really thinking about whether marriage had similar benefits to cohabitation for a contemporary sample, because there's been a lot of research that showed that marriage was more beneficial than living together for couples. But a lot of the data that had been used to examine these questions were somewhat dated and were couples that were living together and marrying in the 1980s and 1990s.
So what data did you use?
We used some data from the National Longitudinal Survey of Youth, and it's a cohort study that's actually conducted by Ohio State University in conjunction with the federal government. And so we're using data from couples that were marrying and living together in the 2000s.
In the 2000s. Okay, so this is relatively recent. So when you're talking about 2000s, it's 2016 now. What stretch of the 2000s are we talking about?
So we're talking about probably from around 2002 until about 2012.
Okay, and what did you ask people and how did you get at this?
So we had five questions that they were asked every 2 years about their emotional health. And it was a survey, so they self-reported this on the phone. And they were followed up every year they were interviewed, and every other year they had these set of questions about their emotional health. So once a year, they were asked about their relationships and their cohabiting relationships and marriages and if they moved in with somebody or moved out with somebody. And so we can track them through those relationships over 10 years and also measure their changes in emotional distress across that time as well.
And what did you turn up?
So what we found was that for women, the transition to living together with a partner, moving in with a partner, was beneficial to their emotional health. And so they experienced a decrease in emotional distress. And that was whether they moved in together and they married or whether they just moved in together without marrying. For men, we found that when they moved into their first unions, so this is the first time they move in with somebody, that they only experienced a mental health benefit if they were getting married.
So interesting. There's a differential there for men and for women. What do you think was going on there for men?
Well, one thing that we thought may be going on for men is that when couples move in together, when they move in together in a cohabiting relationship, men tend to see it more as a testing of the relationship, while women tend to view it more as a commitment and are committed before they move in. So men are kind of testing the ground more often than women, and women are more often seeing that as a committed relationship and just a step on the way to marriage. So women may be experiencing the same emotional benefits that they're experiencing when they move in to a marriage, because they see this as a committed relationship, whereas men may only experience the emotional benefits when they are moving into a more committed relationship.
So does that mean commitment itself is more emotionally beneficial to men and women, because whether or not you perceive that as coming with marriage, that it's the commitment that makes people feel better?
It could be, but unfortunately, we don't have a lot of data on commitment, especially in these national data sets. A lot of times they're focusing on a lot of different kinds of subjects that, you know, scholars across the U.S. are interested in. So in this particular study, we have a lot of data on work and on other kinds of, you know, important questions that people are interested in. So we don't have the data on commitment, but that could be true.
We're talking with Claire Camp Dush right now about a study she co-authored on the emotional effects of living together. And the study shows that women get the same emotional boost from living together as they do from marriage. Men don't. They seem to get that primarily from marriage, is what we're hearing right now. And Claire, what's changed in this generation? Is there anything different about the way these effects have shown up as compared with generations that came before?
So that's a great question, because that was what partly motivated the study. So in the 1980s and 1990s, there were much fewer people that were living together without being married. And so there's a lot more stigma and also pressure from family and friends if you did decide to live together before you got married. And now that stigma has largely gone by the wayside. It's not that cohabiting couples may not experience some pressure to move in together, to get married after they start living together, but there's not the stigma there, with over 2/3 of couples are living together before they're married. So it's a really common experience, and you're not unique to be living with a partner before marriage, whereas in the 80s and 90s, it was growing over that period, but it was much less common.
Were you surprised at all by these results?
I was surprised, because I think I did expect that marriage would still hold a particular benefit for couples over cohabitation, because there's been so much research to show that marriage is particularly beneficial. And so, yeah, I would think that I was definitely a little surprised. And this is a research question I think that we need to start exploring more and more, is what are the benefits of marriage, and what does marriage affect when you get married, and what doesn't it affect, especially because we have policies in place in the U.S., some marriage promotion policies. So we need to think about that hard.
There has been data recently that marriage rates, especially in some groups, are declining. When you take that information alongside what you've learned from your study here, what does it tell you about the direction we're heading in?
Well, I think that a couple things. First of all, I think that it suggests that maybe we shouldn't be as worried about the declining marriage rates as maybe we have been, and that even though some people aren't having access to marriage, that they may still be able to enjoy the emotional benefits of intimate relationships even outside of marriage per se. But at the same time, I feel ambivalent, because it's not that people don't want to get married. So even though marriage rates are declining, most people, like 95% of high school seniors, say that they want to get married. And so I also feel that people should be able to get into the kind of relationship they want to. So I guess I have some ambivalence about that.
And looking specifically at men for a moment, is there a better way than this to measure the emotional stability and well-being of men?
Yeah, that was one of the drawbacks of our study, is that people have made the argument that asking men about their feelings may not be the best way to capture their emotional health, and that you could use a behavioral indicator that may be beneficial. So alcohol use is a really popular one to think about, that could be a behavioral indicator of mental health. So if you're overusing alcohol, that's perhaps a behavioral indicator of mental health issues for men. And we didn't have those data in the study. So it would be great for it to be replicated.
What do we know about the continuing emotional health of both genders as the relationship continues, both in marriage and also with people who are just living together? What do we know about that?
Well, we weren't looking at that exactly in this study, but overall, we find the research has definitely supported that people that are in intimate relationships enjoy better mental health than individuals that are single. And that's partly because of the social support that comes from being with a partner. You have a bad day at work, you come home, you have somebody to talk to about that bad day. You know, people use their intimate relationships to benefit them in a lot of ways, even in terms of their own health, physical health, you know, reminders to go to the doctor. So in general, we know that even when those relationships continue, that people, for the most part, continue to enjoy mental health benefits when they're in intimate relationships.
We're talking right now with Claire Camp-Dush about a study that she co-authored looking at the emotional effects of living together. And the study said that women get the same emotional benefits from living together as they do from marriage.
You can join in now at 800-642-1234. We want to hear your story, your experiences. Have you cohabitated, lived together, maybe before getting married, maybe instead of getting married? How did that work out? How does it compare? Do you feel emotional benefits? Is there something different of between living together and putting a ring on it, tying the knot, getting married? Is one better than the other? Would you recommend one path or the other to, say, a younger person that you know making that decision now? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also share your story on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion now about the emotional benefits of cohabitation with Claire Camp-Dush from Ohio State University.
You could join in at 800-642-1234. As we've heard, this research looking at mainly today's younger generation, it sounds like saying, hey, for women in particular, living together pretty much just as good when it comes to emotional benefits as getting married and living together. And we want to hear what you think about that, what your maybe experience was. Have you done both? Lived together with a partner, married a partner? Did it make a difference getting married? Is it okay just living together? What do you recommend to the younger people in your family, in your peer group? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to those Facebook comments now. Here's one from Sarah, and she says, my mother taught me to live with a man before marrying him. Get to know who he is day in and day out before you decide to live with him every day for the rest of your life. That's what her mom told her. And Sarah, that's, you know, that's kind of a big generational switch from what you might have heard before from your parents saying, you know, never live with someone because they'll never commit to you. What do you think about that shift that we're seeing there through Sarah's eyes?
Well, I think that's, I don't think that's necessarily bad advice. I always tell my undergrads that the most important decision they'll ever make is who they marry. And I guess Sarah, if she takes her mom advice and lives with some guy and it turns out that it's not working out, I didn't mention this, but we also have looked at second unions and we found that people experience emotional health benefits, both men and women, from second cohabitations and second marriages. So, Sarah, if you try that and it doesn't work out the first time, go for it again because you'll experience emotional health benefits in your second union as well.
Wow, so you're on to two committed relationships in one form or the other. Do you know if it just is being in a relationship? Could we go on to relationship 3 and 4?
Well, we have this idea in the relationship research, in the relationship literature, that serial cohabitation, which is living with one person after another, tends not to be, has not in the past been associated with positive outcomes, but that could be changing. Again, we need more updated data as the nature of intimate relationships in the U.S. changes.
We'll go to our phone lines now. We've got Carrie with us in Menominee Falls. Carrie, hi.
Hi.
What is your experience with all this? Good, thanks.
I've had a positive experience. I mean, when you're younger and you're cohabitating, we had some split ups here and there, but we always came back, and you do get to know someone really good, but I like the marriage thing now.
You like the marriage thing. So is this the same person that you were cohabitating with earlier?
Yeah, 20 years living together.
20 years. So I got to ask, what made you decide to, I guess, put a ring on it and get married?
I don't know, because we knew we were going to. We had a son. He was 12. But I don't know. It could actually be fiscal reasons, insurance and whatnot. But mostly because you just know after that long.
Okay, well, Carrie, thank you so much for that. And Carrie lived with her partner for 20 years before they decided to get married. Is that maybe becoming more typical?
Well, I definitely don't think that's necessarily typical. Cohabitations tend to be short-lived in general, but I do think that for long-term cohabitors like Carrie deciding to get married because of some of the fiscal benefits of marriage and just making things official, I think that's pretty common. But unfortunately, we don't know a lot about that from a research standpoint.
Carrie, thanks a lot for the call. We're going to go next to Matt in Chippewa Falls. Matt, hi.
Hi there.
What is your story?
I lived with my wife for about a year, year and a half before we got engaged and then got married.
And how do you feel before and after?
I personally feel...
Oh, no, we lost him right at the good part. Matt, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, do you want to try one more time? Yeah.
Sorry about that. I feel like it's kind of like test driving a car. I wouldn't want to, you know, live a life without knowing the habits of that car, you know, so to say, if it would break down in certain areas or not work in the cold weather or so to say.
And is your wife listening now?
No, I doubt it. I doubt it.
Maybe that's for the best. But okay, so you're glad you did that.
Yes.
And how about now? Do you feel happier now? Because according to at least some of what this data might suggest, you as a guy might be a little happier after getting married.
Yeah, definitely. She's pushed me quite a bit in my personal and professional career to be more calm as a person and settle down and succeed in life and keep on going instead of being, you know, happy with where you're at.
All right, Matt. Well, thanks a lot for that, Matt. You know, everyone's got their analogy. His was test driving a car first, and he's happier now. What do you think of his story, Claire?
Oh, I think that's a great story. And actually, I think that it's pretty common that not only when you get married do you experience, like he mentioned, that his wife is pushing him professionally and personally. Marriage can also be a signal to others that I'm serious now. And especially for men, marriage can be a signal that you're more mature, you're more serious, because some people view young men as frivolous and less mature. So he could be enjoying benefits in his personal professional life from his wife's support and from the way other people view him now that he's married.
Well, Matt, thanks a lot for that call. And next we're going to go to Darlene in Viola. Hi, Darlene.
Hi there. I don't normally call in, but I felt compelled to tell my story very quickly. My husband and I met 27 years ago in former Yugoslavia, and we married after 3 days. And we've been happily married ever since. So a little bit of ups and downs here and there, but I don't believe in cohabitation because there's no serious level of commitment. And this was something that just felt right to both of us, and it's truly a storybook romance.
Darlene, I appreciate that. So Darlene and her now husband got married after 3 days, not very long, and she says she doesn't believe in cohabitation because there's not the commitment. So viewed against your research, how do you interpret a story like hers?
Well, I think that it would, that I don't know that we have a lot of, we don't have a lot of data on dating before you get married. So I'm not really comfortable saying that, oh, marrying after 3 days is a bad idea or a good idea. I got engaged to my husband after only a month, so I'm more like her in that sense. And sometimes I always think when you know, you know. But in terms of cohabitation being not commitment, I mean, there's a lot of variation in cohabitation. So some people might be moving in together to save money. Some people might be moving in together because they're committed and they see this as a step on their way to marriage. Some people might be moving in together because a convenience. So unfortunately or fortunately, among those people that live together, there's so much variation that it's hard to say that they're not committed, because I do think a lot of them do have commitment at some level. It may not be the level of commitment that you have when you're married, but for some of them it probably is.
We're talking right now to Claire Camp-Dush, Associate Professor in Human Sciences at Ohio State University, talking about a study that she co-authored on the emotional benefits of cohabitation. And Claire, do you think that, you know, if we're saying there's some commitment in these cohabitating relationships, do we just have a lower bar for what commitment is now?
Well, I think there's commitment among dating relationships. There's a lot of ways to be committed to your partner. And there's even people that are in very committed relationships, but they're living apart. So they both have their own house, but they are very serious and sometimes even married. So I think that it's hard to put everybody in one little box, and that we just have to trust people when they say how committed they are and trust their feelings. And I think in general that cohabiting couples can be just as committed as married couples. In the United States, people tend to want to get married, but that doesn't mean that, the caller that called in that lived together with her now husband for 20 years, they were obviously very committed.
And back to the callers we go. We've got Carrie next in Janesville. Carrie, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to call and say the advice that I would give to young ladies thinking about marriage or cohabitation would be, I would get married later in life, even 25 or older. I got married at 21, and I'm still married, and it's a positive experience, but it was definitely a lot harder just because we did so much changing in between then. And I think cohabitation is great because during that changing of time, there's so much that happens, and I think that women are just becoming more independent, and I think it's a great thing.
Well, thank you so much for that, Carrie. Appreciate that. And Carrie's going to get the last words with our caller. And before we let you go, Claire, we just got a few seconds left, but is this sort of research going to change the way that we think about marriage? Do we need to rethink why it's such a big deal and why it's desirable in the first place?
Potentially. And I think that there needs to be more research on what the benefits of marriage is for Americans. And we need to think more about how we talk about marriage. I don't think marriage is going anywhere anytime soon, but I think it's important for us to not discount other kinds of intimate relationships.
Well, Claire, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was Claire Kamp-Dush, Associate Professor of Human Sciences at Ohio State University. She joined us there to talk about a study that she co-authored looking at the emotional benefits of cohabitation.
You'll never get away with this, Riddler.
Would you like to make a little wager?
I never gamble.
That's the distinctive sound of a fight scene on the 1960s TV version of Batman.
The show debuted 50 years ago today and only ran for 3 seasons. Like a lot of shows with a short run, it lived on.
Now, if you've only watched, the Batman movies from the last couple decades or read the Dark Knight comics, I got to tell you, the old TV show was really different than what you might be used to.
Right. It's more along the lines of, say, the original Star Trek with the sort of ill-fitting uniforms or costumes, whatever they were.
Yeah.
And a lot of stuff is very literal. The pow, bam.
Right. Literally, you'd see the words pow and bam show up. We can't really convey that on the radio.
Which I kind of like.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because what is that punch sound? Oh, but it's pow. It's pow. Okay. Yeah, no, I would say what you're saying about Star Trek, only more so. Like, definitely campier. Great villains, too, right? Vincent Price.
Yeah.
A lot of good Catwoman, women.
Burgess Meredith as
the
penguin.
Yeah, so a lot of good stuff there in Batman. This, we were just looking this up. Not a reboot for a Batman TV show in the works. There's new DC Comics movies. I've got to think they're going to do it very different if they ever do another Batman TV show.
I think I might rewatch these if they reran them. Sometimes the new Batman is too dark for
me. Dark.
I kind of like the pow bam.
This is not a dark show.
No.
We'll go out with the theme song here on Central Time. Stick around. There's more to come.